Welcome back to Better Vibes. I'm your host, Brad. For all your aquarium and better fish needs, come to us and listen to today's episode for the history of betters. Episode 2, let's kick it off. These beautiful fish captivated my heart, as they have done with so many people around the world, not just for their stunning colours, their fin types and whatnot, but their great bold personalities that they have. These beautiful fish have a lovely history deeply rooted in Southeast Asian culture, from tradition and science. They have started off with the most humble of beginnings and ended up with royal courts in between and modern day aquariums. So let's dive into today's episode and look at the history of the betta fish. Betta fish, also known as betta splendors or Siamese fighting fish, which is not a good representation of them. But overall, they originate from Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. They thrive in shallow, warm, slow-moving waters like rice paddies, ponds, and ditches. These waters that they naturally inhabit, the wild types especially, have low oxygen levels, which has allowed them to evolve an organ within themselves called the labyrinth organ, which allows them to gulp air directly from the surface. These aren't the only species of fish that has this, but it can be a little tricky to also notice if you have low oxygenated water in a community tank. Keep that in mind, all right? But nothing to be super worried about, okay? Bettas look very different. When I say bettas, I mean betta splendors, as they're more, or betta pliquets, look a lot different to their wild type cousins. Now, there is many types of wild types, and they have a great hue of colors, but they aren't as bold and flamboyant as our betta splendors are. And because they aren't as bold and as flamboyant, they had their browns, their greens, their grey colorations as a natural defense mechanism to help them blend into their vegetation and muddier type waters that they love to live in. If you look on YouTube, you will find a lovely gentleman who has done some documentation over the last couple of years of finding wild bettas in today's areas of Thailand and Vietnam and things. And he's found that more often than not, these are usually in flooded fields, heavily, heavy kind of banana style trees and things like that, where there's a lot of vegetation in the waters. And we always try to keep a beautiful, clean tank for these guys, but I feel that looking at their history, they it's not that they love to have a dirty environment, it's that this environment adds so many natural things for them. So when we tannin up the water using Indian almond leaves and other botanicals, it is actually antibacterial properties and a lot of other things that helps them thrive and survive. So having tannin water is never a bad thing. The betta fish started their lovely fighting, as it's referred to, but it's really not technically fighting. It's a little different to that. but they were admired for their boldness and territorial nature, because part of their mating process is to fend off the other males and show the female that I'm the biggest and I'm the best. So the males would spar to defend their space, and this was seen as, you know, something that enticed people and wanted to do something with it, as humans love to. And that's how they got their name, Plaquet, which means biting fish. And the locals who started noticing this and started breeding the fish originally would find the strongest and most most resilient individuals, and they would breed them to make them more bold and show flaring more, so that they would win the sport. Because it wasn't about a blood sport as such, it was a test of endurance. The winner was usually the fish that didn't back down. So it was more of a Mexican standoff. If you want to put it into those words, it's probably the best way to put it. Betting became a huge part of the contest when it comes to the fighting as such, which is more of Mexican standoff, as I said. And the King of Siam at the time regulated the ownership of bettors, which meant that they taxed it, and historical records have shown this. Plus, the king even gave prize specimens to colleagues as royal gifts. So they were highly, highly prized, to the point that, a little tip, most expensive betta fish ever sold was a very specific Thai flag betta, which sold for just over $1,500 US. It is an absolute beauty of a specimen of a fish, and the Thai flag variation, which must be one of the most hardest to honestly breed. Like, I do some breeding, and getting your colorations to come out as you want is inherently hard, but that's a different episode. When we look at the breeding of these over the centuries, because it has been over a millennia, 1,000 years these guys have been captively bred for, the focus was always on the temperament and resilience for fighting. This temperament and resilience, we can still see in some of the colorations and the aggressive nature of some of those variations today. You know, the more newer variations, like the dragon scales, are a lot more placid and calm in comparison to those older types, being like veil tail, crown tails, and even some of the half moons and things like that, because they were the more common varieties, which didn't come about as such until the 19th or 20th century. But the selective breeding process that came from to get these temperaments and resilience for fighting that they were looking for created a mutation within the fish, and it changed from those wild type bettas that we're used to seeing, which there is an amazing array of those, but they also mutated into some of the colour variations that we see today, our yellows, our greens, our blues, our reds, our blacks, which you will not find in a wild betta type as such. You might find pigmentation of some of these, but not solid coloration, because once again, this comes back to their natural environment. And if you could imagine a bright red betta being out in a murky rice field, it's going to stand out and get eaten by a bird or something like that, unfortunately. Where if they are more of your dull colorations, as you could call them, unfortunately, a wild type, you know, are kind of referred to as the brown fish of the breeding, you know, bettas. But they have a specific purpose for that colorations. But when it when these variations started to happen, the, not just the color variations happened, but also the variations of the finish started to happen from a plaquette type or a spade type, which I think the spade type tail is completely underrated. We don't see enough spade type tails anymore, and it is a magnificent species and specimen, because a spade type is actually a true variation of a wild type tail, which gives them probably the highest amount of thrust out of anything and the greatest amount of movement when it comes to it. And with all these variations that came over time, this is how we've got to our better splendors today. How did the better get across the world in the last 200 years? It's almost 200 years. It's incredible. Actually, it's over 200 years. It's almost 250 years. The Europeans started getting the bettas around 1849, which were known as splendid warriors or better splendors. And that really started to, I guess, grow the aquarium hobby overall and start leading up to where we are today. In between bettas and koi and goldfish, our aquarium hobby would not be what it is today, that's for sure. I got to tell you, if it wasn't for these pioneering fish overall and people that wanted to keep them, we would not have, you know, beautiful fish that we did today. Did you know that even in Roman times, they would keep fish within the house in some of their pools and whatnot that they had in some of their gathering areas? They were not kept in great scenarios, and of course it wasn't the best scenario overall. A lot of these fish were probably either sea caught or river fish as such, or possibly a bit of both, and they mixed them together and they wouldn't have lasted very long. But history of fish keeping goes all the way back past Roman times. All right. In the late 19th century, so the late 1800s to the early 1900s, we started seeing the fish come over to the United States as well, and they really took on the breeding of the bettas and changing, well, I wouldn't say changing, but breeding more specifically, which, yes, this means that just like it has in the past, there is a lot of inbreeding and line breeding of bettas. It's just part of the hobby, unfortunately, that if we want to have all these beautiful, magnificent variations that we do, a lot of line breeding or inbreeding, unfortunately, does happen. Now, of course, there is side effects to that. That's a different story and episode, but it is just the part of the history of bettas. When it did come over to the United States, the focus wasn't on the fighting. It was more on coloration, finnage, patterns. And this led us to have our beautiful veil tails, crown tails, double tails, half moons, sun, full suns, you know, and the traditional plaquette type. And, you know, those spade type tails have kind of been forgotten about because of all these beautiful variations, and I have most, if not all, of the variations apart from spade type. Getting a spade type here in Australia has been extremely hard, and I'll keep my eye out forever. But you know, and then with them breeding, this has allowed them to change colorations to everything from, you know, you know, just not just a singular colour like your reds, your blacks, your blues, but also the helmet types, and rims. So when we look at a lot of the half moon large finned fish especially, or even just the half moon plaquettes, you might have a solid body colour, or your fins might be of multiple different colours. And when I say that, it will be rimmed around the outside of the fish, of the finnage there, a different colour to the rest of the finnage. And this can be seen in the Thai flag especially. And it's also allowed people to breed things like the koi coloration and also the galaxy variation or aliens, and also then furthermore into the dragon type, which, you know, there is issues with everything today, and it's something that you've got to keep a lookout for. There's a lot of things that happened. Unfortunately, I had one of my lovely female dragon betters get Diamond Eye. Now, Diamond Eye is not a good thing overall. It is not a death sentence, but it is something that does make the fish blind. You can go to selective vets and they can remove the scale that grows over their eye, which everybody labels as Diamond Eye. I've seen it in some pet shops and it's disgusting to see that they're selling a fish with Diamond Eye as a great variation. These are not great variations. These are a genetic deformation that is allowing that scale to actually change colour over their eye and will continually to grow back, unfortunately. So if you do have a fish with Diamond Eye, it is a hard choice to go down along. Modern better culture has led us to have the most, or one of the most popular fish in the aquarium world. When we look at this fish, it captivates our heart as soon as you move in, walk into any aquarium anywhere across the world. And even if they're kept in poor conditions, they will be the first fish that will come up and say hello to you, basically, at the front of the tank, and they will want to interact with you. And the personality is just incredible. Each one is different. I have so many of them. I'm doing this podcast today, just so you know, guys, from my breeding room as such, which houses about 10 or so fish tanks in here. You probably can hear water running in the background. That's my tanks. Right now, I'm surrounded by almost 200 bettas from about 2 months old up to a couple of years. So it's something to keep in mind. Your betta shouldn't last 9 or 12 months. In good conditions, they can live up to 5 years in total. But knowing how old they are is a tricky one, which we touched on, I think, in for episode one there. So keep that in mind. But they are now bred more for competition, and competition has had some bad stigmas about it as well. But these colour variations that we're seeing come through at the moment are usually bred for competition. And without that competition, we're not going to evolve our beautiful nature of our fish and allow them to show their full potential, which is amazing what they are. If you ever get a chance to go down to a better competition, please head down and have a look. They are not kept in poor conditions. They are only kept in small containers for a couple of days, so please do not think that that's how they're going to live their whole entire life. Those fish are not going to die when they leave there. They get sold, if not sent back with the owner of the fish, okay? So there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to competitions of fish. They are I wouldn't say my first go-to fish to sell somebody as a beginner fish. They are probably the most colourful fish that you could have generally as your first fish. And the reason I say they're not usually the first fish, it's because they are not the best community fish overall sometimes, and they limit to what you're able to have in your tank in comparison to other type of species. So as I mentioned earlier, gouramis are beautiful fish as well, but you can't have a gourami and a betta in the same tank together. They don't get along because labyrinth breeders together will have issues. So keep that in mind, all right? Do your research before getting your first fish. Please, please, please do not buy anything smaller than a 20-litre tank. And I only recommend 20-litre tanks for large finned, especially Dumbo styles of bettas. I like to think of the larger the fins, the more effort it takes to get around your environment. So you don't want to have a huge environment with them, and you want to have an extremely slow water movement. So a sponge filter is always best for the larger finned varieties. And how can we relate that to ourselves? Now, you know how hard it is to walk somewhere where you're a huge wind blowing into your face and it's like you have to lean into it? Well, that's a better on its best day if you have medium to high water flow. Now, what would it be like if then I went and put a parachute behind you, just a small one like the runners use to train and things like that, while you had a massive wind coming into your face and you're trying to move? You're not going to want to move, are you? You're going to get dragged backwards. You're going to go lay up against the side of your tank and not do much. These are common signs that you've got high water flow and that your fish is struggling. So, as I said, sponge filter, absolute best way to go with a betta, and some of the best filtration in general for everything I find. And also a 20-litre minimum tank. If you have a Plaquette version, please look at least a 40-litre tank. And remember, the larger the water body, so the larger volume of water that you have, the easier it is to actually look after. So when starting out in the hobby, getting a 40 or 50-litre tank is so much easier than having a 20 or a 10-litre tank. 10-litre tanks are notorious for crashing, changing their parameters way too quick, killing fish off. Unfortunately, it happens to the best of us. But the smaller the water is, the quicker the parameters will change and become deadly. If you're not keeping an eye on things very specifically, it can become so bad so quick. All right, so keep that in mind. Now, our bettas play a key role in our education, conservation of environments and whatnot through Thailand and Vietnam, and they even stretch into art and in all things these days. Breeders continue to refine the patterns, and I can't wait until I actually see something new come out, which I can't even think of at the moment, because I thought we had it all, and then they found aliens and dragons and stuff like that. So anything's possible from here, guys. While domestic bettas are absolutely stunning, we have to remember that they wouldn't be here without their wild type cousins, which still exist in the wild, and there is so many captive breeders of wild types and collectors of wild types. I know a couple of collectors here in Australia that are almost, it's like they're Pokemon. They have to catch each individual species of wild betta. It feels like, not that they're actually going out to the wild and trying to catch them, but they have so many different varieties of them, and they are magnificent creatures. They remind us of what the bettas used to look like and what centuries of selective breeding has changed our lovely fish into. Conservation is so important through their native habitats across the world, and I hope that we are able to save a lot more of those environments where they are, as they are under threat from due to, you know, urbanisation, population, pollution, and farming, which all go hand in hand as we're expanding out into the world and becoming a higher population civilization. These areas are becoming under threat. A prime example of this would be here in Australia. We had the southern peacock, the southern purple spotted gudgeon, which was thought to be extinct up until 2016 from the early 1980s. If it wasn't for a study to be done prior to a study had to be done before a building could go ahead. The study found that there was a few of these left in a natural swamplands over in South Australia, and now that is a wildlife sanctuary and nobody can build on it, hopefully forever, because we need these areas all for our fish, our wild species of fish, to keep thriving. And with everything that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to educate everybody about bettas and try to learn about how our amazing fish came around. There is so much more that you can look into, very more specific things that you can look into and find online through Google. There's plenty of studies and history documentations if you wish to go have a look at it further. I encourage everybody to have a look at the history of any type of fish that they actually have and at least find out where that those fish came from, so that we can appreciate them more. We really want to, you know, make sure that those varieties are not just something that we have in captivity in the long run. I think for today's episode, we will probably wrap it up about there, guys. When you look at your betta, remember, they carry centuries of history from the rice fields of Thailand to your tank. Understanding their background helps you give them better care today. Larger tanks, live plants, warmer water, and respect their intelligence and instincts. They are incredible, okay? And please treat them as they are. And remember to have appreciation for both domestic and wild type bettas, our connection to the species, and the culture that shapes them helps us understand where our lovely betta is going to go from here and into the future. I'd like to thank you all for joining me today into this little snapshot or the snapshot. I'd like to thank you for joining me today in this little snapshot of history into betta fish. From humble earthy colorations, fighters in rice paddies, to dazzling personalities swimming in our homes, bettas have travelled a long way to every breath of the world. Into our next episode, we'll dive into science and betta genetics and uncover how some of those incredible colours, fin shapes, are created. Until then, thanks for keeping your tanks thriving, and let the betta vibes be positive. I'm your host, Brad. I hope you have a lovely day, and I'll chat to you next time.